Hello and welcome to Work Talks, IBEC Employer Relations Podcast. It forms part of the IBEC Voices series. I'm your host, Kieran Cudahy, and Work Talks aims to share strategic thinking into all aspects of employment relations. We hope to offer unique thought leadership on the employment landscape in Ireland, examining future trends, legislative and regulatory developments, and insights into the practical application of employer relations policy in real-life workplaces. This podcast is for you whether you're a HR director, a CEO, CFO, or anybody working at any level in an organization in Ireland, large or small. In this episode, we'll discuss the hot topic of diversity and inclusion, top of the mind of so many leaders as we move into the next phase of employment relations post-COVID. I have a great panel of guests with me today, including Maeve McElwee, Director of Employer Relations at IBEC.
So there's a real long-term focus, and we see that very much in terms of that move more towards a stakeholder view of the world rather than just looking at shareholder values. And diversity and inclusion really plays a very important role in all of that.
I'm also going to be speaking to Fiona Mullen, the Chief People Officer at Ding, and Oisin O'Gogan, HR Director at Aon Ireland and the Nordic Region.
What this pandemic has given us is a real opportunity to rethink the type of things that we do. My own view has always firmly been that no organisation is diverse or inclusive by default. This is all intentional and by design.
I kick things off with Maeve McElwee, and I put it to her that the business case for diversity inclusion is at this point well made.
It is, Ciarán. I think, you know, we've a pretty well-established case for diversity and inclusion across the board in terms of the impact on businesses. So we can really see how it lends itself to attracting talent. It drives engagement with our businesses. It really impacts on workers' satisfaction and can be a huge contributor to improving performance across the board. And I think, you know, when we look at how the world of work has been changing, this whole area of diversity and inclusion is something that IBEC has been looking at for a really considerable number of years now. But when we look at what's happening in the external environment, you know, how quickly our world of work is changing, you look at the political, the social, and even the business trends, we can see the impact that all of those things have on diversity and inclusion in our workplaces. And I'm thinking particularly here around, you know, the opportunities, but also some of the challenges that things like a lot of populism and the polarization in our societies is driven and that we're seeing being driven through at the moment. So, you know, looking at that greater desire for collectivism, looking at some of the challenges to some of the big movements we've seen in the last couple of years, like the hashtag Me Too, the Black Lives Matter, and even that, you know, growth in union activity where people want to come together as a collective. All of those are really important issues for how we look at diversity and inclusion and the importance in our businesses. We've been looking for a long time at that real impact, I suppose, at the broader societal level. You know, with some of those really standout issues for employers being around things like housing, infrastructure, childcare, transport, and their impact on diversity and inclusion, and how, you know, where they're in place, they can actually really drive participation for lots of people in the labour market, drive opportunities to be able to manage that diversity and inclusion that lends itself so well to our businesses, and where they're not there, the challenge that then presents for how we drive some of that within organisations. So there's a real long-term focus, and we see that very much in terms of that move more towards a stakeholder view of the world rather than just looking at shareholder values. And diversity and inclusion really plays a very important role in all of that. And even then taking it down to the level of the organisation, Ciarán, the work that we've been doing around our Smarter World, Smarter Work campaigns, you know, just looking at how those policy issues are underpinned by diversity and inclusion across the board, where we're looking at things like lifelong learning, so education and skills, and that importance in making sure that we all have good access to the labour market. Flexibility to make sure that we have opportunities for people to participate from all different backgrounds and walks of life and for longer within our labour market. So driving that diversity there, And really importantly, I think for the next number of years, is that whole dynamic labour market, where we look at how the regulation is playing through and we see lots of opportunities. And COVID, which I'm sure we'll have to talk about at some point, the opportunities, but also some of the challenges that COVID has presented in terms of maybe new workplace flexibilities that might be of assistance, but also the challenges that that has presented, and maybe some of the slippage that we have seen as a result of COVID around the diversity and inclusion that we have in our workplaces at the moment, and where maybe the focus has lapsed a little bit. So I think, you know, at every turn, wherever we look in a HR and in a broader context, diversity and inclusion is really becoming the heart of a lot of what's driving our organizations, and really a very critical part of how we look to really flex and, you know, drive creativity, drive, you know, that broader social good that our businesses can bring as well.
When you talk about slippage, Maeve, over the last 12, 14 months, what do you mean?
Well, I think obviously many businesses have been very focused on just getting through the crisis. But I think it's clear that there are some emerging concerns that as a result of COVID, that some of the focus that we've had on diversity and inclusion has probably slipped a little bit. We know even just some of our more recent research around the impacts on women in particular over the last number of months, probably some of the most visible in terms of our recent research, that we are seeing significant numbers reporting that, you know, where challenges come up across COVID, particularly impacts of childcare, homeschooling, burden of household responsibility, additional stress and pressure, need for more early hours and late working, it has predominantly been women who have been reporting those challenges and seeking those accommodations. And we've made such progress in terms of trying to ensure greater levels of participation and access, and addressing issues around gender pay gap. It's really important that we don't see that slide. And particularly as we look to the future and we see legislation coming around right to request remote working, that we are, you know, I suppose has a bit of a laser focus really on how that's going to work and how we make sure that we continue to include everybody, and we really drive that community of inclusion within our workplaces so that people who are working remotely, and most particularly if it's largely women, that they don't get forgotten or missed. I think it will be really important that we do utilise this time to have a look and see how quickly and easily it can happen, that without that continued focus on diversity and inclusion, that it can slip away and the work that gets done can slip away very quickly. So I think we do need to use the experience and to build on that experience, but also to build on the opportunities that it has given us. Because more than anything else, I think we have really begun to work on that great experiment of how we can actually work differently. We can see what can work very well. We can also see what hasn't worked very well, and we can use that to build, to look for other opportunities to be able to make sure that more people have more access to participate in the labour market in the ways that they need to, and, you know, to be able to achieve a much better balance.
Well, with me as well to talk about all of this and more, and maybe give some direct examples and practical examples of the types of things Maeve has been talking about, is Oisín O'Gogan, HR Director with Aon Ireland in the Nordic region, and Fiona Mullen, the Chief People Officer with Ding. Oisín, I suppose when we talk about diversity and inclusion, there is a minimum bar in terms of legal compliance, but the conversation today is about an awful lot more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think really what's at stake here is there's an understanding that the level of maturity when it comes to D&I or IND or your preferred acronym in each organization really varies. And what this pandemic has given us is a real opportunity to rethink the type of things that we do. My own view has always firmly been that no organization is diverse or inclusive by default. This is all intentional and by design. So, you know, leadership teams are presented now an opportunity to really think about how we engage our colleagues, our largest and most powerful stakeholder for the most part, and the type of things that we can do to communicate with them to involve them more in the conversation. So I think it's really a question of how we develop greater cultural competence around diversity, equality and inclusion. Throughout, I'll probably refer to ED&I, that is the preferred AN acronym, which is equality, diversity and inclusion, which I think covers the majority of these aspects. But certainly the conversation has broadened for us and has given us an opportunity to enhance and actually improve many of the, I won't say initiatives, I would say many of the larger scale strategic plans that we have to engage our colleagues. If I were to maybe, Kieran, and tell you about some of the things that we're doing, but our program has really centers around four key platforms, the first being education, the second being around recruitment, third around promotion, and fourth around representation. And under each of these pillars, we make mark efforts to do things that demonstrate we are both a diverse and inclusive organization, but also to engage colleagues in that. If I were to use a simple example around education, the pandemic has afforded us with an opportunity to access a much wider reach of colleagues to educate on these topics. A transition to online learning allows us to target and also get access to colleagues who may not have had the time or the interest in offices to attend sessions. Whereas now we've triggered something new. We're able to engage in a new way via technology. And that has really helped us with that. I'm a firm believer around representation here also being a really strong pillar. You know, as an organizational level, it's very important that you see all different types of colleagues at leadership level and other levels. And that has been a significant area of focus for us, which we achieved through many of our promotional channels.
Fiona, to what extent has diversity and inclusion, and it's interesting that Oisin talks about equality, inclusion and diversity, or diversity and inclusion, that it's been an evolving concept, and this conversation might have been very different 5, 10, 15 years ago, would probably be different again in another 5 years.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, like many, I've been in the HR world for all of my career. And, you know, there was a time when we started off really focusing on the business case for diversity to kind of win over why this was the right thing to do and make it, in a sense, prove that it delivered business value. And we've moved on now to a situation where it's just the right thing to do. And in essence, customers, clients, and the employee base is demanding this of their organizations. And so, as Oisin has said, the conversation becomes much more sophisticated, much more socially driven. And even when you use that word, we're talking about equality, we're even looking at concepts of equity, because there was a time when HR departments were building programs, if you like, that were fair and treated people equally. But then when you think about people coming into the workplace with quite different lived experiences and have unique needs, more is being demanded of us to make employment experiences and benefit programs that essentially speak to the individual. We now have millennial demographic coming into the workplace who have been brought up quite in an individualized experience online and expecting to be accepted for their individual identities in the workplace. And that's a huge but really interesting challenge for this kind of conversation, which, you know, when you think about small, medium, large organizations, it requires them to be really socially sensitive to the kind of programs that they're building. So the discussion has really matured, and I would say accelerated in the last 12 to 18 months, in some degrees because of the pandemic and largely because of the social change that Maeve has mentioned in relation to issues of justice, where we've seen the impact of the Black Lives Matter movement, and then issues of sexual harassment in obviously well publicized at this point. So really heightens the stakes for organizations and brings diversity programming right to the heart of business planning, not just to the employee experience, quite honestly.
And Oisin, you talked about equality and about some of those issues as well. How much of a role does mental health now play in diversity and inclusion policy?
Yeah, I think what we've really noted in particular in the last 12 to 18 months is greater intersectionality between the topics of diversity, inclusion and well-being, which encompasses mental health. You know, when I think about this, you know, our homes have become our offices, and we have never been more involved in each other's lives. I take today as an example where we look into each other's homes when we speak. So that by default has really shifted, you know, the type of conversations we have with colleagues and the considerations we have in how we work with others. I think a classic example I always remember in my first HR role dealing with in a banking organization, largely predominantly of alpha males, very dominant, and I would have said at times difficult to work for. The shifting paradigm for me was seeing them at a Christmas party holding their young children. I looked at them very different. And I think about that experience as the experience we have now is when we work remotely and work in a virtual world as we do, I think we start to see people quite differently. We've never seen more children, dogs and cats running around in the background. And I think that has humanized how we work a lot more. And so when I think about mental health, absolutely, I think the level of awareness we have is much greater. I think some of the things that we are doing at Aon, which other organizations are also doing to success, is really bringing that conversation about it's okay not to be okay. And most recently, we've been running a program called This Is Me, where colleagues are encouraged to bring and share some of the examples of challenges they face or have faced in their lives. And I think that lets us all, you know, talk a lot more openly about some of the experiences that we have, removes the stigma associated with mental health challenges. You know, without knowing the specifics, there's multitudes of research that has taken place over the course of the last year, which suggests that all of us, no corner of the world is untouched, where all of us at points in time have had mental health challenges, be it big or small. And I think we are recognizing that that's an important part of who we are. So, yeah, absolutely. I think this gives us an opportunity, again, as I said earlier, to rethink how we support colleagues and how we design our organizations in a way that allow us all to continue to have those closer under the surface of the water connections, which ultimately, you know, will lead us to being more innovative in how we work. Will lead us to being more cooperative in terms of how we interact with one another and ultimately giving employees and colleagues a more pleasant work experience.
Oisin, when we talk about the phrase allyship, what does it mean?
Allyship can really be, it's a very personal thing to everybody, but I think an ally really for me is someone who works to advance that culture of inclusion in an organization. Who is willing to challenge the status quo and to help establish structures that support those who are in some way marginalized. You know, allies can be formalized allies or allies by default again. But I think for the most part, you know, we have been asking and see leadership in particular throughout the pandemic, but, you know, long before that, leaders who have, you know, been allies for colleagues, again, who sit in those marginalized parts of our organizations. I think allyship really starts with an individual. And the principle around allyship is really having a curiosity to learn more about different individuals and diversity as it sits within your teams. You know, again, a curiosity to build your own skills in order to address it. But I think what an ally really does is it shows a bit of a backbone in terms of calling out inappropriate behavior, you know, having the ability to, again, formalize structures and to reinforce some of the messages that we have in organizations to make sure that, you know, change is sustainable, that everybody notices what we are doing into the future. But I think in summary, ally is somebody who stands up for others. That's it. Put simply, and thinks more broadly about, you know, the now and includes everybody who's not in the room.
Fiona, have you, when you're listening to that
description of an ally, have you examples from your own experience, whether in Ding or elsewhere, that come to mind?
Yeah, and look, this issue, not an issue, this theme of employee activism is very real, most particularly in tech companies, because A, the culture it breeds it, it creates it, it asks for high levels of engagement, expect high levels of engagement on everything, not just the good things. And so allyship in calling things out that are difficult, and sometimes that has been really uncomfortable in the organization. It may be going from the individual, as Oisin has said, but going to something that's more collective, which is the organization doing enough? Is the HR function doing enough? Are leaders doing enough? And being able to, be brave enough to have that conversation out in front of the whole of the organization and not feel like you're going to be demonized or somehow negatively impacted as a consequence of that. And there's been well-reported examples in the Googles and Facebooks of this world where that activism has been, you know, well publicized and even come out onto the streets. And that's really interesting. It's really uncomfortable to be in the middle of that from the HR standpoint. But in a way, it's illustrative of a highly engaged workplace whereby employees expect to have a say and expect to hold their culture and their leadership to account for achieving the things that they say they're going to do. And when you have a social media platform internally within the organization, you have a megaphone, and using that megaphone for, you know, good and uncomfortable ways is a great way to make change happen quickly, because we have seen that change happens quickly externally through, you know, press and social media. And we can then also assume that change happens quickly internally when you create moments of discomfort, and whether it, and particularly around issues of how marginalized people might be treated or perceived that they are treated internally. So it's as I said, it's a growing theme, particularly in tech companies. You know, I choose to be an optimist insofar as it is uncomfortable to experience it, but very positive in terms of its overall impact on the organizational culture and levels of transparency.
I think we've got a good understanding of diversity and inclusion and its importance. And as Maeve said, listen, that the business case has been well argued and that argument has been won. And that has been the case for some years. If we want to move on then to building sustainable diversity and inclusion in workplaces, I'm conscious, Oisin, we talk about them as being together, continued diversity and inclusion, but one doesn't necessarily lead to the other, does it? I mean, you could have a diverse workplace and it might not be very inclusive.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's always worth reminding about what these terms are. And I think they can be bundled up in times, but there is merit in pulling them apart and looking at them individually. And, you know, to remind ourselves that diversity really just refers to the mix of people that you've got in an organization at any one point in time. Inclusion is the array of behaviors you display in order to make people feel included. And I think in addressing both of those separately is where you arrive at what we call cultural competence, which is when people believe, think, and demonstrate all of those characteristics of diversity and inclusion. If I were to maybe share a couple of examples, but ways to improve diversity, you know, often stem with who you bring into your organization. You know, we've seen in the last month that the globalization of the world with the last period of time, should I say, has demonstrated the globalization of the world, which ultimately gives us access to much more diverse talent than we previously would have had before. Organizations to date have been looking at the recruitment strategies, both internal and external, to promote a more diverse organization. So, you know, in looking at the mix of people, the diversity of your group, I think you have an opportunity to really take stock of who you have. You know, it doesn't take much other than to look around and see who's in an organization. So I think looking at recruitment strategies, both internal and external, is one way to address diversity. But there, for organizations who've maybe stepped beyond that, there are also other options of doing things like self-ID campaigns, where you ask colleagues to, on a voluntary basis, tell you more about them, share with you some of the demographics and some of the factors that are defining for them, which allows us as an organization to look at our total diversity. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be race, gender, and some of probably the more obvious things. You can have diversity of thought. You can have lots of different types of diversity. I think it's just important to understand and embrace that. I think inclusion is a very different matter, where, as I said, this is about the types of ways and behaviors that are demonstrated in your culture that give you that cultural competence. And to maybe just share a couple of examples of defined behaviors for inclusion, they are things like valuing the individual differences of your teams, taking time to make mutual contact amongst groups and individuals, you know, accepting responsibility for decisions, a very important one, and seeking and giving feedback. So these types of behaviors allow us to ensure that colleagues, teams, leaders are all involved in that discussion. They are ultimately included. But I think the most important of all inclusive behaviors is really that ability to address inappropriate behavior, because it has to stop somewhere. A line must be called. And I think the combination of looking at who is what is the degree of diversity in your organization, also reassessing the types of behaviors that you demonstrate collectively as a group, that combination of D and I should give you the cultural competence. You know, that is purported to be the winning and successful formula. Who knows if those ingredients are correct? They're evolving all the time. But certainly in my experience, that has been it has been important, should I say, to look at each both separately and then together.
And Fiona, what are the practical things, the simple things? I was going to say low-hanging fruit, but maybe that sounds a little unambitious. But the simple things that companies and people listening to this, employers and HR professionals, can do to try and bring them closer to that point of cultural competence, as Oisin described it?
I don't know if it's a simple thing, but actually, I'm going to start with leadership, because there's lots of simple things you can do. But if leadership isn't really role modeling an inclusive style on a day-to-day practical basis, those little things won't make a difference, because leaders have long shadows, for better or for worse, and what they do and don't do, say and don't say, make a huge difference in the organization, because they will conflict or accelerate the impact of all of the work that teams, managers, and the HR function will do to breed a culture of inclusion. And the challenge we face is that leadership generally at this point in time, particularly CEOs, with the most respect to the bunch of CEOs that may be listening to this podcast, is that they are generally middle-aged white men at the last job or their second last job of their career. And they haven't developed themselves through their career necessarily in all cases, really exploring this. So they're coming at it, if you like, leaders who know a lot about their business, they know a lot generally. And this is the thing that they probably know least amount. And yet they have the most impact on the organization, because they influence their teams and the organization that they lead. So I would start there in all cases, quite honestly. And I think the most impact will be had if leaders are in learning mindset and they embrace the fact that they're in learning mindset and they can share vulnerabilities around not knowing a huge amount and look at practical things like, who are they spending time with? Are they seeking input from around their organizations, from minority groups that can give them insights that they would not be hearing from their executive team, for example, around what it's really like to work in their company? And they can make change happen really quickly. And so the challenge that people like Oisin and I face is, have we got leaders that are open to that conversation? And there was a time when, you know, leaders bought the business case and they would sponsor, but they wouldn't necessarily understand how to go really deep in their own learning. And so that is essentially, I think, the work of today, is leaders spending a significant amount of time really engaging with the organization and learning themselves, understanding the needs of their ethnic minority groups, understanding the needs of their LGBT groups, and being able to affect change as a consequence of that, like invest in benefit programs that suit the needs of, you know, same-sex parents, for example.
Can that be a delicate issue to broach with CEOs, Fiona? I mean, you know, as you said, they're in either the last or the second last job of their career, more than likely a he, and they know all about this company. They're obviously very successful. They wouldn't be in the job if other people didn't think they could make a success of it. And you're going to say, well, listen, there's actually this thing that's really, really important to the company, and you know nothing about it, or you know very little about it. You're kind of a dinosaur in this world.
That is a potentially a career-limiting conversation to have, but it is the conversation that Oisin and I need to have, otherwise we shouldn't be in the job. And I'll give you a good example, and it's an extreme example, but Uber lost their chief people officer for not taking issues of diversity seriously. And that accountability sat with that role and that person. And so it's had a hugely positive impact, for negative reasons, on the role of the HR leader in every organization. So if we're not doing that, we're not doing our job right. I think many CEOs, I think we underserve their emotional intelligence here, because they are reading what's going on in the marketplace. They're looking to their consumers, they're looking to their peers, and it is their peers and their consumers that are telling them that this is what is needed. And if you look at a lot of the leadership surveys out there, this feedback is coming back. So they are in many cases looking to be educated, but they're not necessarily hearing the right coaching and support and being given the right education that enables them to do that. So I think there's more openness to that in the first instance, but perhaps a little less bravery than we need to be having. In my experience, at least, and I think COVID is helping us here in that, to Oisin's earlier point, we all recognize that at the very starting point, we are all human and we are all individual. And we've learned that, you know, more about our families. We've learned how health is important. And so I think leaders have become more confident in being vulnerable and accepting that that isn't necessarily a weakness. That's in fact a strength, because it opens them up to lots of other channels of communication that wouldn't otherwise be available to them. I think leaders are in an interesting position, but equally, I think, surrounded by a lot of great supports that will enable them not just do this correctly, but also grow their business as a consequence.
And Maeve, to bring you back in, it's quite obvious listening to Oisin and Fiona that companies have moved far beyond strict legal compliance. A lot of companies have. The best companies, the companies who care about that cultural competence, again, to use that phrase, that they've moved beyond strict legal compliance. Does law and legislation need to catch up with what is happening on the ground? Is that the best way to deal with this? Or is it to continue to allow that cultural change to happen organically?
I think there's probably a combination, Ciarán. So I think, you know, it's really important to recognize that we have some very important equality legislation in place. And that legislation has been a very significant base from which some of these conversations have actually gotten off the ground, and we begin to change the culture and the mindset. And of course, it's important that there is a structure within which some of these things can be regulated. I do think, though, in lots of areas, we are moving ahead of just strict legal compliance, and that's exactly where we should be. In terms of whether legislation needs to catch up, I think I'd argue that we need to be careful around legislation, because it's very difficult to catch up in an area of diversity and inclusion, because legislation by its very nature tends to be a really blunt instrument. So you do want something, obviously, that provides protections and rights and sets that floor of equality for individuals within the workplace. But actually what diversity and inclusion about it is much broader. And one of the challenges that we find with legislation, so particularly things like this upcoming right to request remote working, is that actually individuals, as both Oisin and Fiona have been describing, have different needs within the workplace. They have different identities, they have different challenges, they have different levels of engagement depending on issues that are happening in their lifestyle. And what employers have very much started to shift towards is dealing with people as individuals as they expect to be addressed and engaged with in the workplace. So, you know, legislation can tend to take the focus off the individual because everybody has to be dealt with in exactly the same way. So I think it's really important that we were mindful of always building on the legislative base, but we should be going further. And we should, insofar as we can, be careful to actually address what the real needs of individuals are and how we best serve those.
So I wonder then, and to bring things full circle, Maeve, if policymakers wanted to give Oisin and Fiona and their colleagues the space to continue their work, is legislation and intervention better focused on some of those other areas you mentioned at the outset, like housing, like childcare, and getting all of those building blocks in place so that, I suppose, people and employers and employees have more opportunities afforded to them?
I think without a doubt, it's really important that we do focus on some of those issues, because really they're the conditions that set the opportunities for people to be able to participate and to be able to have access to the labour market in the first instance. So many people get excluded by virtue of an inability to actually access the workplace or inability to be able to find the childcare with the adequate number of hours covered to actually be able to offer enough hours to make it financially viable to be within the workplace. So they're definitely the conditions that we need to see addressed in the first instance. They're kind of like the hygiene factors that allow people to get to work. I'm not saying that legislation doesn't have its place, and I'm not saying that legislation around employment rights and engagement shouldn't evolve. The challenge is to try and manage legislation in such a way that it's flexible, because as Oisin has said, this may be right for right now, but that will change as people's needs change and how our workplaces will develop. And the challenge with legislation, even when we look at things like our Organisation of Working Time Act, it hasn't evolved and it hasn't changed to the fact that we're now a much more flexible, global, integrated workforce across borders. But it's still a very important health and safety piece of legislation. So it's always about trying to find that balance.
Maeve McElwee, Director of Employer Relations at IBEC, thank you. And my thanks also to Fiona Mullen, the Chief People Officer at Ding, and Oisin O'Gogan, HR Director at Aon Ireland and the Nordic Region. And thank you for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of Work Talks. So make sure to subscribe or follow for free so that you don't miss out.